Why do so many dogs die before their time? Actress and dog activist Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. Superfood Complete by Badlands Ranch is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including premium protein-packed beef, nutrient-dense organ meat, heart-healthy salmon, gut-healthy vegetables, and several superfoods vital to your dog's health. And because high-heat cooking can add unhealthy things to your dog's food, Superfood Complete uses air drying, so it gets cooked low and slow. This means it has the convenience of kibble, but the health benefits of whole foods. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible benefits, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 right now to get up to 50% off your order and a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's badlandsranch.com/save50 today. All dogs are unique. Your dog's results can and will vary.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side, your Sleep Number setting. And now, during our Veterans Day sale, save 40% on the Sleep Number Special Edition smart bed. Limited time. To find a store near you, visit sleepnumber.com.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. I'm so excited to be welcoming my friend Philip Kennedy Johnson back to the show, and to be welcoming for the first time the incredible and prolific writer Mark Guggenheim, who I recently met at a convention, and he graciously gave me his email address, so I'm so happy to have you both here. We're going to be reviewing Incredible Hulk number 180 in the latter half of the show, a story that we are titling And the Wen Cried Flesh Eater, because we don't use that W word on my show. We've talked about that in previous weeks out of respect for the Algonquin peoples, but we will get there in the latter half. I'm so happy to have you both here on the show with me. My name is Chad Anderson. I'm a former Marvel Comics handbook writer, current host of the Grey Malkin Lane podcast. Let me have you share your name and pronouns, where we might know you from, and my question for today intro, what's the scariest monster you ever created for a story at Marvel Comics? Let's begin with the incredible Mark Guggenheim. Mark, welcome to Grey Malkin Lane.
Hey, thanks for having me. This is fun. I'm Mark Guggenheim. Pronouns are he, him. Probably know me. I worked on a show called Arrow on the CW for a number of years. The scariest monster I created for Marvel was I did a run on Blade with Howard Chaykin, and we did an issue where I had created a character named Animus, who basically, he was a monster, but he had no form. He had no body. He actually jumped his consciousness from body to body to bodies. What made him kind of scary is that he would, you know, basically put himself in the body of like children and nuns and whatnot to make it very difficult to kill. And that was just a great deal of fun.
People love to bring nuns into a horror story.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I probably didn't have a nun in that particular story. It was a Christmas issue, and a character jumps into the body of a mall Santa, and that was really just my excuse to, like, I just want Blade to fight a Santa Claus. How do I do that? How do I accomplish that?
And it gives me strong Hatemonger vibes, if you guys know the character Hate.
Yeah, a bit. Oh yeah, yeah. Isn't Hatemonger's pretty sure running for president this year. Too soon?
There's a few versions of that. Yes, absolutely. In real life and in comics. Let me also welcome the incredible Philip Kennedy Johnson back to the show. Philip, it's been ages. How are you?
Yeah, good, man. It's good to see you again. So yeah, Philip Kennedy Johnson, him, and I'm best known for, I'm doing Batman and Robin right now. I've been writing, I wrote Superman for quite a while, Alien, Incredible Hulk now for some time, which is, I imagine, why I'm here today. And the creepiest thing I created for Marvel. In issues 2 and 3 of Hulk, actually, I brought in a creature called Urdu, Brother Deep, which is this cosmic horror that was fossilized in this dead coal mine. And at some point, the coal mine had caught fire. And that's based on this real town in Pennsylvania. Centralia is a town where like there's this coal mine's been on fire for like 60 fucking years. They had to abandon the whole town. So I made up a town much like that. And the like the microbes that are in the fumes from the fire, like raise the dead and make them into this hive mind kind of thing. So there's this creepy old church on the surface where it's like a Southern Baptist church kind of, or like primitive Baptist, really, like a certain kind of Baptist church. But they're, you know, the crucifix is off the wall and there's this old rune in its place and they're all praying to something. And it sounds almost like they're like singing hymns and stuff. But the thing that they're singing to is clearly not Jesus. And they're trying to like dig this cosmic horror thing out of the mine. And I don't know, I love Brother Deep. It's pretty fun.
It's like a blood church of like Hicks. I don't know. We're going to read a story in Appalachia in a little while. Well, we started out there and then end up in the
Canadian woods.
This story we're going to read in the latter half gives me strong Philip Kennedy Johnson, Incredible Hulk by Bottas. There's the Hulk jumping around and fighting the monsters, right? Like,
yeah.
I'm enjoying your run so much. And it's so great seeing you thrive writing these giant books. I know you're a very busy person, but
thanks, man.
I'm just here to celebrate you, dude. I'm so happy for you.
Thank you, brother. You too. Both you guys. It's an honor to be on here with Mike. If I may say so, it's an honor to be on here with Mark. I think the world of Mark.
Thanks,
love
man.
Love his work.
Oh, thank you, buddy. The feeling is so mutual. And you are such a mensch. You know, there's some people on Twitter who were coming after me a couple of weeks ago. And Philip just, you know, totally on his own out of the blue is like, you know, got your back, man. People are jerks. And it was just so nice. It's just, it's really one of the things I love most about writing comics, actually, is we have this wonderful community of just good human beings. There's this, I will say, I think the quality of person is equal to the quality of artistic talent in the comic industry, which I would say is very high. Philip and I had a chance to like very briefly collaborate on Green Lantern together. And it was like, this is really cool. I love working with this guy.
Mind blowing to have the two of you here. The episode immediately following this, which continues with the first appearance of Wolverine in full form, is Paul Jenkins and Erica Schultz, who's another just kind of random combination of people. I love putting ensembles together on this show as like a guy who does professional interviews. It's so fun seeing the camaraderie that exists among professionals in the industry. Mark, I normally will open and like ask for your origin story and your bio. We have so much to talk about though that I'm going to automatically invite you back for another episode where we can cover more. I want to focus my questions primarily on your X-Men run, just so we can get through as much as possible for our listeners who are especially interested in that that era of your career. Mark, of course, has done a lot of incredible things, from the aforementioned Arrow show to writing the Wolverine origin video game to the One More Day Spider-Man, you know, MJ marriage, Mephisto stuff. There's so many crazy eras of your career that I'm so fascinated with, including your work on S.H.I.E.L.D. And I know your wife is a super prolific writer as well. There's so much I want to talk to you about. So early invitation for a return to the show, please. Focusing, I want to start with your run on X-Men Gold. I know this was a very different time in your career. It's also a very different time for X-Men readers specifically. Tell us a little bit about how X-Men Gold came to be and what some of your mission statement jumping into this book, coming out of the Bendis years with all of the crazy time-traveling X-Men stories that were so heavy. Like, there's 8 characters of every version running around.
I knew when I took on the X-Men Gold gig that it was basically a custodial gig. It was, you know, to really just create a bit of a stopgap between the end of the Bendis era and what was going to be the Jonathan Hickman run. It turns out that Jonathan actually ended up starting his run much later than expected. So X-Men Gold went on for longer, and then Matthew Rosenberg came in with Uncanny X-Men, sort of fill in the gap leading up to the Krakoa years. But basically, I had done some work in the X office, specifically I'd done an arc in Adjectiveless X-Men, which at the time was all female X-Men stories. Because when you look at me, you think, oh, you know, women. And Daniel Ketchum was the editor, and he basically was made the editor of X-Men Gold. And I think he enjoyed my run and we enjoyed working together. He's like, would you like to do this? I'm like, absolutely. There wasn't a whole lot of like sort of guidance, you know, in terms of a mandate. The only mandate really mainly was they wanted the mansion to be in Central Park. And certainly,
yeah, remember that, listeners? Remember that time the X-Mansion was in Central Park?
I really had like pretty much carte blanche to kind of do what I wanted to do. And my goal really was to take a very John Byrne-esque back to the basics approach to the book. I love Bendis' run, but it was a lot of time travel and a lot of big swings. And I knew that I didn't know the specifics or the contours of what Jonathan had in mind, but I knew that obviously it being Hickman, that there would be some very big swings there. And I just want to like tell some just tried and true meat and potato X-Men stories. And for me, the X-Men, they're sworn to protect a world that hates and fears them. And I really want to tell stories along those lines. And I had certain ideas, like I wanted Kitty to be the leader of the X-Men for a variety of reasons. Kitty's like my favorite X-Men, not just because she's Jewish and I'm Jewish, but because my very first issue of the X-Men that I ever read as a kid was X-Men 139. It's the Welcome to the X-Men, Kitty Pryde, Hope You Survive the Experience.
Oh man, what a great place to jump in.
Yeah, right? It was really perfect. Actually, by the way, particularly good for the conversation we're going to have about Hulk 181, because that featured the return of, and I don't remember the Algonquin term for WGO, but you know,
we're just gonna call it the Flesh Eater.
The Flesh Eater. Well, that you know, featured the return of him versus Wolverine. So it was like, wow, everything's just coming full circle. I had a blast with that book. I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, another issue where there's a monster chasing somebody around, right? We're gonna talk about monsters a little bit today. Your run on X-Men Gold is really interesting. I got to do a reread of it for the first time in a little while. You're using classic characters, but you seem to really be focusing on, rather than retreading the same old types of X-Men stories, really pushing it. You give us Alpha, the sentient sentinel. You give us space gods. You give us a new gay pyro to date Iceman. There's all these different kind of characters running around. Some of them bizarre, like Cleavis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there were some really weird ones. I mean, I will say this, like, again, for me, the gold standard of sort of taking over any book, if you're trying to sort of do a back to the basics kind of approach, is John Byrne's run on Fantastic Four. And in fact, the first issue of his run is called Back to the Basics. And it was a great example to me of like telling classic stories, but also putting a lot of new pieces on the board, inventing a lot of new toys and pushing some things, you know? So Back to the Basics doesn't mean going backwards so much as it means, to me, just focusing on what is the true essence of this thing, and then how can I come up with stories that sort of speak to that essence?
Yeah, you tell some really interesting stories that are surprising, especially with characters like Nightcrawler, but I want to focus on Kitty Pryde and Colossus for just a minute. What you do to their relationship is heartbreaking, with Kitty leaving him at the altar. I also wanted to ask about what it was like to write that kind of Jewish wedding with Rabbi Yarkin leading things and Kitty's mom there. Clearly, there was a lot of touching moments there.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I have to say that, you know, I can't take credit for the Kitty walking away from Colossus to the altar. That was not my original plan. My original plan was to marry them, and that was part of my original pitch. But there was a Marvel summit. There were just concerns that even though Kitty and Colossus have sort of been aged, you know, to be compatible with each other way back when it was first introduced, you know, Kitty was 13 years old and Colossus was, you know, at least over 18. It was seen as like that relationship being inappropriate. I was sort of pitched like, you know, he goes to put the ring on her finger, it phases through. She's like, oh my God, what did I do? And then goes away, and then Rogue and Gambit get married. I was like, I think I can make all that work. I'm like, can we get extra pages for this issue? Because it's a big tanker to like turn around. You know, that's a big oil tanker that's in the ocean that I'm slowly trying to move. And the more pages I have, the more real estate I have, the better that story will be. And in terms of the Jewish wedding, obviously, Kitty being Jewish, I always wanted them to have a Jewish wedding. At the same time, around the time I was writing that book, my daughter was doing her bat mitzvah. And I walked into the office of the rabbi who was tutoring her, and she had all this Marvel paraphernalia up on the wall. So I'm like, are you a big Marvel fan? She's like, I love Marvel. I'm, you know, huge into Marvel. And that was Rabbi Yarkin.
That's phenomenal. Two questions I want to ask here. Number one, tell me about the creation of Simon Lasker, who is Iceman's terrible, terrible choice. He's like fucking this fire guy on his team, and he knows it's just not the right thing. I mean, who among us has not made...
well, honestly, that was the whole idea, really. It was like, you know, a lot of times, you know, in every medium, you write romances that are romantic and are great. And they sort of elide the reality for most of us that you kiss a lot of frogs before you end up with the prince. And I wanted to give Bobby this wrong for him kind of relationship. So I wanted it to be an evil mutant. Then I thought, is it too much? Am I gilding the lily too much to have it be a new pyro? Because at that time, pyro was dead. No one called me on it. In fact, not even online, where they call you on everything. No one was like, that's a little too on the nose. It tickled me. And I like telling stories about real people and real relationships. And again, who among us, you know, gay, straight, whatever, hasn't dated the wrong person, hasn't made a phenomenal mistake. It just seem good fodder for storytelling.
This one's a selfish question. I don't think anybody cares but me, but the creation of Olivia Trask as the granddaughter of Bolivar Trask, what was the, like, who's her dad?
Oh, God, I honestly don't know. That came about because I wanted a character kind of in the vein of Stryker, Reverend Stryker in God Loves, Man Kills. Because I'm kind of, and this shows up actually in a lot of my X-Men work, I'm kind of fascinated by the very weird form of bigotry in the Marvel Universe. Now bigotry by its nature doesn't have to be and certainly isn't rational, but the idea that, like, oh, I love, you know, Captain America, but I can't stand Cyclops. That's a strange bit of bigotry. I'm always looking for different ways of, like, sort of getting, quite frankly, getting into the heads of the bigots and giving them a point of view. I think it's kind of my own sort of sick fascination. Like, you know, I don't know how political I'm allowed to get here, but, like, I am fascinated by anyone who wants to vote for Trump. I just have this sick, I want to understand.
This is a queer liberal show. You're fine.
You know what I mean? Like, I've got this, I don't know, this weird itch that's hard for me to scratch where it's not that I want to forgive the bigot. It's that I just have a sick fascination. I just want to understand it. I can't explain it. It's weird. So Olivia was basically one of my many attempts over my X-Men writing years getting ahead of one of these anti-mutant people.
I want to ask you 10 more questions just on X-Men Gold, but the last one I'll ask for today. And then next time we're going to talk about Young X-Men if you come back, because I have.
Yes, because we got to talk. Honestly, if we're going to be on the Gray Malkin podcast and we're going to talk about queer characters, we've got to talk about Gray Malkin.
Gray Malkin and Cypher, but we're going to save it for the return visit. So everybody, please eagerly anticipate a return. I'm going to hope for that myself. The selection of the name Prestige for Rachel, and then this connection that she gets with Mesmero, who's kind of releasing her dark side. I know you got to write Rachel in Days of Future Past as well. As a quick aside, I do a monthly maxi episode. It's kind of like an academic nerdy panel on one character every month on my show. And we do like a criminal trial. And we give them a rating. And we've done some bad people, like Madam Hydra and all kinds of bad people. The only person to ever get like the worst 100% worst asshole in the Marvel Universe score is Mesmero. It's just like worst character. But tell us about the selection of the name Prestige for Rachel.
You know, I'll be honest with you. That was like one of the least successful aspects, I think, of my run. Again, it was sort of built out from this idea of I wanted to portray Rachel in a way that was outside the shadow of her mother and outside the shadow of her lineage and sort of really establish her own identity as an X-Men. To that end, I wanted to give her a new costume and I wanted to give her a new name. I'll be totally honest with you, and this is probably too much of an insight into my process, but I basically, in my notes app, I just keep a list of names that I want to use, and I wanted to give her a new name, and I went down the list, and I'm like, Prestige sounds good, and I still think Prestige might have caught on a little bit more and been a little bit better if the costume wasn't so goddamn awful. And I blame myself, because I felt like I didn't see the designs for the costume ahead of time, and I should have given them more notes, and I didn't, and that one's on me.
Thank you also for making Stevie Hunter a congresswoman, another key decision on your part that I'm so pleased with.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of stuff in both my Young X-Men and X-Men Gold runs that haven't really sort of like lasted longer, or just sort of other writers haven't really picked up any of the threads. But for me, Stevie is one of my favorite X-Men characters. I think it's such a tragedy that she literally fell off the radar. Given the opportunity to do X-Men Gold, I'm like, I've got to get Stevie in the book. And the whole idea that she would be a congresswoman just made sense to me. I love her worldview as a character. So I wanted to see that, you know, represented in Congress.
It's a fantastic change. And again, I have a thousand more questions. We'll save these for next time. For the sake of time, and I know we have a lot to talk about, which is why we're jumping in. It's Halloween month on Gray Malkin Lane. We're going through the X-Men books chronologically. We're just getting to the Wolverine stuff, obviously, right before Giant Size launches. Philip, it's fortuitous to have you back. Three things I see the two of you have in common is you both love writing monsters, hicks, and bigots. Something I see as a theme in books you're writing quite frequently.
Yeah, I was going to say, based on his political statements, we have more than that in common.
I digress. So a question for each of you, similar but different. When you are offered a franchise like The Incredible Hulk, Philip, or like Wolverine, Mark, how do you approach the types of stories you want to tell? Both of you do some really great horror focus in these characters' realms. And I know you do it in a lot of your other books, but we're going to talk about Hulk and Wolverine today. So I'd love to hear, how do you throw yourself into this particular particular universe and tell the types of stories or mission statement you're going to come up with. Philip, you want to take this first? You've got Hulk pitted against ancient monsters and his transformations are so creepy.
Pretty rough, yeah. I knew I wanted to make that change. Like whenever I see Hulk just kind of swell up green like a balloon, I'm like, we could have gone harder here. I want to see skull plates coming apart and I want to like really embrace how painful this has got to be, right? Like these are not just, it's not like getting the pump at the gym. Like your whole self is just getting destroyed and remade in like a few seconds. It's got to be insane. And I just wanted to see that. I thought that was kind of like almost like a Spider-Man's webs, like a McFarlane webs kind of moment where there's just no going back. Like, do you know what I mean by that? When McFarlane was on the book before that, it just been some lines with the gray shit in it. And then he just put all this work into it and just changed the whole game in that regard. I want Hulk's transformations to be gross from now on.
And Al Ewing kind of started that with Immortal Hulk, with just this really awful, monstrous, ugly, disgusting.
Yeah,
blasted apart.
You're right. There was some of that. It was still kind of like him just swelling up, but that was definitely the most horrific we'd seen it.
You really amped up. So how do you approach a character like this who has such a steep continuity and decide what direction you want to take him?
So the elephant in the room was Immortal Hulk, because that was an awesome book. And when they first asked me to do it, the biggest challenge was like, how do I not just do more of that? How do I not just ape what Al did? Because I just wanted to do more. I just wanted to see more of that book, you know, but I didn't want to just copy Al. So I'm like, shit, what am I going to do? That's not just carbon copy of that. And I kind of sat with it. And instead of looking for other Hulk books to inspire me, I just thought about other creepy stuff that I admired, because I knew Immortal Hulk had kind of sucked all the air out of the room and had kind of forever, in my opinion, had kind of steered the trajectory of Hulk books forever, like a little bit different than they had been. Like before, you could do a superhero Hulk book and it would be okay. But after that, some characters just have that thing, have some element of it just kind of baked, forever changed. Like imagine Swamp Thing as like not a book. You know, it just doesn't make any fucking sense. I know that when Al had done his version of Immortal Hulk, it was like a kind of a black science kind of take on horror. It was like it was all happening in like laboratories and it was all about the science of gamma and, you know, a very Cronenberg kind of take on it, in my opinion. I felt the influence of Mignola kind of coming out when I was, the more I sat with it, I wanted it more of like a folk horror kind of take where instead of laboratories, it's happening in like in bogs and fields and under hangman's trees and just a more like Southern Gothic kind of folk horror take. I had to kind of take a little time and just kind of wallow around in creepy shit and just kind of decide what I was going to do different. But I decided to go more of like a mystical eldritch horror kind of take. So that's how I kind of set the difference. There's a lot of influence from Hellboy, from Hellblazer. There's a really beautiful adaptation of Beowulf that I really admire by Rubin and Garcia. Those things just kind of permeate this book and make it less like scientist notes and more like a bestiary, like a mythology.
When we get into the issue review, we see Loner Hulk, right? He's in his child, like dumb brain damage era, but he's like, Hulk is Hulk and Hulk is Hulk's friend and Hulk needs no one, right? But he's punching wolves in the woods. You've got that version. You've resisted the urge, maybe it's a clear decision to not use the giant supporting cast of the Hulk, which so often get brought back into the book from his kids to his girlfriend to his, you know, evil father-in-law. Has that been a temptation for you?
No. it's not that I don't like the cast. There are a lot of elements of the Hulk's history that, okay, here's a big change, or probably the biggest change I wanted to make is like, what is this book about? What does it mean? So, you know, between the Immortal Hulk and my run, there was also the Donny Cates run. And in that run, Banner like basically enslaves Hulk inside of his own mind. Like
in a starship pilot. Yeah, it's a weird.
Yeah, it's a very different kind of take. Banner deeply wrongs Hulk in that book. And I thought that was a really good setup to make Hulk the proper monster of the movie, you know, to make him like the thing that, instead of seeing Hulk overcome these other monsters, which of course we also see, Hulk is really the scariest thing on the page. He's like the thing from The Ring or It Follows or Smile that's actually stalking the host. Banner is terrified of Hulk. That's a very different take, you know? So instead of, you wouldn't like me when I'm angry, where the Hulk kind of shows up when he's pissed and bails out Banner. Now, it's like, you know, all of us have that thing inside of us that we hate about ourselves or that we are afraid of. Like, I would have everything I want and my life would be perfect if only whatever. If only I could get up in the morning. If only I wasn't an alcoholic. If only whatever their thing is. If only I didn't get so angry at work. You know, whatever their thing is, they have that thing that stalks them and breaks everything.
Yeah.
And that's what Hulk is now. I needed Hulk to be scary.
Mark, same question for you when it comes to Wolverine. Wolverine is a character that has a deep and rich history, and you are looking for ways to try to tell scary horror stories. You got him right after Civil War. It's kind of a unique time.
So first of all, in terms of any time I write Wolverine, I'm always chasing the original Claremont Miller miniseries. To me, that's the best distillation of Wolverine as a character and everything. It's funny, I started writing Wolverine very early on in my comic book career. In fact, the Wolverine Civil War tie-in was this only the very second thing I'd written for Marvel. And then I had this moment in the Civil War tie-in where basically I like reduce, you know, Logan down to like a blood cell. He was sort of interested in the question of, well, how does that happen? Like, where does his soul go, basically? And how does that work? And I will say, like, it was in the early days of my comic book career, a lot of the stories that I was writing were stories that came out of asking myself a question like that. And I honestly don't think it was really the best way to generate comic book stories. I kind of look back on that period going, ooh, I wish I had done that a little differently. The whole sort of notion of like Wolverine's soul, and you get into sort of very Dante-esque questions and that sort of move you in this hellscape kind of horror direction. That arc, that series was, I don't look back on it with as much affection as I do a lot of other stuff I've written. I think basically at the end of the day, like, there's stuff I've written that I'm proud of and I think has aged really well and is really, really good. And then there's other things where I feel like I was spending so much time trying to answer a question that I wasn't telling a good story. That Wolverine run, if I'm being totally frank, is sort of falls into that latter category for me.
But that, like, demon in hell messing with him with his healing factor is really interesting. Jason Aaron later, of course, sends Wolverine to hell for like an extended period.
Yes.
And there's lots of ways to tell these kind of horror themed comics, right? The claws, yeah, popping, the returning from death, the demon possessions. Both of you are writing those in brilliant ways at different places in your career.
Oh, thank you. That's really kind. Again, I can be pretty sort of harsh on my own stuff. The internet thinks they're the harshest on my own stuff, but no, they don't hold a candle to me. And the funny thing is like, you know, again, going back to Wolverine, that original Wolverine series being sort of the gold standard, for me, the second Wolverine story that's the gold standard is the Kitty Pryde Wolverine series that Claremont did with Hal Milgram. And that is what introduced this whole idea of demonic possession. And
Ogun, yeah, you know, with the mask.
Ogun, yeah. Exactly. Horror elements have always been a little bit of the part of, you know, Wolverine's DNA. I think it's occasionally interesting to sort of like go back to and sort of examine. I think Hulk and Wolverine have one thing in common. Those concepts and those franchises really lend themselves to a wide variety of different interpretations. So you can tell an action story, you can tell a superhero story, you can tell an espionage story, you could tell a horror story. Whereas there's not every character in comic book canon is that malleable.
To do a comparison, Wolverine fits into all those stories. Hulk, you have to really force into one of those stories, right? By giving him some sort of limitation and applying, because it's the man monster.
It is. Well, you know, it's funny. It's like, if you look back at the original, you know, the original early Hulk days, I mean, he was like a superhero. Admittedly, like, not the smartest superhero on the block, but he was in the Avengers and the Defenders. He's the only Marvel character who was on the starting lineup for both teams. An espionage story would be really impossible.
Well, they've done that. Did the like Mr. Green version of the Hulk, where he had like all the spy intrigue happening. Like, there's some ways to do it, which is, Philip, your approach to the Hulk seems to be really smart. In today's market, you want to build up like a good story that lasts the right amount of time, right? And you've got Hulk kind of cursed and ready to face this monster, the Eldest, which is of course where you're going to end the story. But as the story is successful and you keep going, you just get to keep adding new monsters, but you still have that conclusion pending whenever it needs it. I've been really impressed with the way you've done that. I think some writers get really trapped in the, am I going to get 5 issues or 10 or 12 or 18? Has that been a nice platform for you to be able to create new monsters? And I'm so impressed, by the way, at the amount of backstory and pathos that you give each monster that Hulk is defeating.
Oh, thanks. Like, you know, like the remembrance of Eldest things at the end of each issue, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's been fun to get to write a little bit of prose at the end. When I first came onto the book, another thing that I was thinking of a lot was these Marvel team-up books that I had when I was a kid. My love of comics came from a relatively small stack of books, and I mostly learned the Marvel roster through these Marvel team-ups that I had. It was primarily Spider-Man teaming up with some no-name. That's not true. Not all of them were no-names. Some of them were huge characters you'd recognize, like Hulk or Ghost Rider or Doctor Strange. But sometimes it'd be somebody a little less commonly seen. And that's how I learned like the difference. But like that and like Brave and the Bold is like how I kind of, you know, segregated my comic piles, started to realize who belonged with whom. I did not have a lot of consecutive books, really. They were all second, third-hand comics, very ripped up. And whenever I had a couple issues that were side-by-side, it was like a big deal. I don't know. I love the one-and-dones. I love the ones that are really short, where I actually got to see the whole thing because most of them were just fragments of stories. I would have loved to have something like later in life when I, you know, I managed to get a hand on like the Fatal Attractions collection or like the Death and Return of Superman collection. It was like fucking mind blowing because before that it was also like bits and pieces of stuff. I knew I wanted Hulk to be just a series of constant jumping on points. And even though there is like an umbrella arc happening, it's not like jumping into the last three issues of Dark Phoenix Saga or something like where you must read everything or you're just screwed. I wanted every arc to be just like one issue, two issues, maybe three issues, but certainly no longer than that so that the readers all get a full thing. So I always kind of had this modular kind of approach where you do see like every little arc does have some relationship beats that carry their relationship forward, bring them towards a city they're trying to get to or something. But you can pick up any one issue of the book and have a great time and put it if they don't want to continue, it's okay. They've had the experience they paid for and not be required to buy 15 issues of back reading to even be able to catch up.
It's so fun just learning from the industry greats and hearing your process. It adds more to your stories. I love getting to know you both. We could talk for 3 hours, but we're already going to start to transition and I have so many more questions. I want to do a Hulk-Wolverine comparison for just a minute. This issue will introduce Wolverine in that final panel. There's an interesting juxtaposition between these two characters in particular, and because Wolverine first shows up in the Hulk, we have a lot of follow-up adventures of the two of them fighting, right? The first time we meet Wolverine, he's hacking at the big giant monster. And then, of course, Sabretooth and a million other giant monsters follow. Hulk is kind of the archetype in some ways of Marvel's Atomic Age hero generation. All the heroes from Spider-Man to the Fantastic Four to the X-Men are all connected to atomic radiation. And Hulk is like the guy who gets caught in the gamma bomb and transformed as a result. Where we go a little one generation later as the Silver Age is ending, and Wolverine kind of represents that post-Vietnam shift that's happening at Marvel, where we get the lonely kind of Rambo veteran anti-hero who uses violence and has an evil berserker side that he can go crazy. So both of these characters have a monster within them, but they come from different eras and they're very different types of heroes and characters. Pitting them against each other is a really interesting thing in your brain to kind of measure out a little bit. Do you have any thoughts on the Hulk-Wolverine connection or what makes these two effective when fighting each other? The 5'3" guy versus the giant green monster.
I mean, it's kind of the unstoppable force against the immovable object, right? They just kind of embody that schoolyard nerd debate. Like, who'd win in a fight? Superman, Darth Vader, or whatever. You know, like, Hulk and Wolverine is just always a story.
Or David and Goliath, right?
I was thinking...
Well, kind of, but it's... I mean, yeah.
I was thinking Rocky and Thunderlips in Rocky 3, just to date myself.
Yes, he's small, and it's a fun comparison physically because Wolverine is so small, but he's also unstoppable. And, you know, Hulk is like the biggest, strongest thing. So it's just a fun debate to like think about in the same kind of way that Hulk and Thor is fun to think about. I mean, that's different, of course, because they're both big, but it's just one of those mashups that's always fun to think about that will keep coming up.
The Hulk is, according to Peter David, at least the stories we get later, the Hulk is the personality that kind of shows up to protect Bruce Banner from his trauma. It's a trauma response unleashed by gamma radiation in some ways. And he's got the heart of gold, but he'll punch anything he doesn't understand at the same time. Wolverine is a product of military experiments. He doesn't have access to his memories. His berserker side shows up. He's got the part that relates to wolves better than humans. Whereas the Flesh Eater character is the man turned into the monster, the soul of the man trapped in the monster, unable to escape. The juxtaposition of these three and the man-monster motif that we're building in this issue, I think, is really interesting.
It's important to sort of note that like Wolverine as a character has really evolved over the many years and years and years. And like when you first meet him in Hulk 181, or I guess at the end of 180, when you first meet him, he's a very different character. You know, he's a much lighter character. He doesn't have that whole sort of dark kind of, I was experimented on and I have, you know, no memory of my life. He's actually very quippy. He's practically like Spider-Man in those Hulk issues. My attitude is like, it kind of depends upon which era of Wolverine you're talking about, you know, and sort of who's writing him. And it's interesting, not to digress too much, but it's interesting that like Len Wein wrote those issues of the Hulk, but also wrote Wolverine's appearance in Giant Size X-Men. Clearly, Len's vision for that character and his backstory was very, very different from Chris Claremont's vision. It's just a different...
Absolutely. So even though we've done some exploration of Wolverine, again, we've been going chronologically, so we've put in some of the modern stuff, like the Wolverine origin series. But to introduce this character, we're going to be reviewing Incredible Hulk number 180, which we are calling the Wind Cries Flesh Eater, which doesn't have the same alliteration, but you can all go cover itself. Len Wein is the writer on this book. We're going to be doing some major celebrations of Len Wein in the new year as we get to Giant Size X-Men number 1. The penciler on this book is Herb Trimpe, who we'll also talk about more. I've befriended Linda Feit, who was married to Herb at the time, and we've talked a little bit about some of his experiences, including the creation of Wolverine. Len Wein created this character, but Roy Thomas says he kind of gave some of the suggestions. John Romita Sr. kind of designed it, but Herb Trimpe's the one that kind of drew him, and now everyone's dead except Roy, who says, actually, he's my character, but it's kind of Chris Claremont and Larry Hama and other artists that really fleshed this character out. We're just talking about how Wolverine's a very variable character, but he's also a very consistent character. I think Wolverine and Hulk are both very consistent, depending on the type of story you're telling. The inker on this book is Jack Abel, Christy Shields on colors, Artie Simek on letters, and Roy Thomas is the editor. We're not going to get lost in the weeds of the story of Wolverine's creation, but do you guys have any opinions on who created Wolverine?
I think it's horrible that Roy has waited for everyone to be dead before making this sort of play. In my most charitable moments, I would say that it's opening up a Pandora's box if you're going to include the editor in the credit of creation of a given character. I think if you are going to do that, you've got to do it across the board. There's a good reason why editors aren't considered co-creators. Giving input, giving notes, that's part of the editorial job. It's not the act of creation. It's the act of, what's the word? Editing. There's a big difference. That's, if they were called co-creators, they'd be called co-creators. It's like, if you invented Facebook, you would have invented Facebook. It leaves an incredibly bad taste in my mouth. I'm trying to be polite.
No, I think that's okay. Phil, do you have any opinions here?
I think it's shady as shit. I would jump right in with what Mark's saying. I don't know Roy, so I can't speak to anything that happened. It was a long time ago, but yeah, the fact that he's the last man standing, and then suddenly he's like, actually, it was all mine. It's pretty, it's colossally lame, in my opinion.
I've interviewed Roy twice. I will not ask him this question, though.
Yeah, that's fair. By the way, he may volunteer the next time.
That's true. Previously on Grey Malkin Lane, back in Incredible Hulk 162, which we covered, we learned the story of three French-Canadian hunters who were trapped in a storm and being hunted by a pack of wolves. One of them, named Henri Clouzot, died, and a starving second person, whose name is Paul Cartier, ate his flesh, not knowing that they were on cursed land. We talked about the curse of the flesh eater in the last episode. If you eat flesh in this place, you become a flesh eater. You are trapped inside this ever hungry monster who is a big white furry Sasquatch looking dude that roams the land, sometimes in packs. And there's a lot of crazy flesh eater stories across Marvel's history. Hulk battles the monster. He can hear the voice of Paul Cartier crying out to him from within the monster in that issue. And eventually Paul becomes the flesh eater completely. His consciousness is now lost. Paul's sister, Marie Cartier, who we see here, as well as the third man who had been trapped, Georges Baptiste, now are determined to save the soul of this monster. And that's the story that Len's following up on from that previous Steve Englehart story that we reviewed. Now, in the previous issue, Len Wein is the new writer on this book. It's a new creative team coming onto the Hulk in this era with Len Wein and Herb Trimpe. In their introductory issue, the Hulk fights a different kind of childlike monster, a guy named the Missing Link. And now we take the Hulk back to Canada, where we have the Flesh Eater story happening. Had the two of you read this comic book before? Is this a story you were familiar with or revisited recently?
I'm embarrassed to say I had not read this before.
I had read 181, but no, I haven't.
181 is the follow-up to this. See the next episode for the conclusion of this story. But one thing I'll say right away here, which is insane to me, and this is where I have a lot of comic writing aspirations myself, and like being the Silver Age guy that is gathering all these details. These characters, Paul Cartier and Marie Cartier, who we see resolved in the next issue, who are both alive and well at the end of it, they have never shown up in another Marvel comic book. That guy who became the Flesh Eater and his weird sorceress sister have never shown up in 50 years of continuity, which is crazy to me.
Yeah. Huh, that's interesting. When I saw her with like the little headdress and all that, I was like, I don't know. I thought maybe there was like some B-lister Asgardian character or something that I was like, is this can't be who I think it is. Like, surely it's not Valkyrie. So I was trying to make sense of who she was.
It's just a white woman adopting Native American traditions for her magic. You know
I see.
As one does.
As one, yeah, of course.
When we jump to Incredible Hulk number 180, we get the Hulk kind of crouching down as he's being hit in the back by a giant rock as the Flesh Eater swings it. He attacks again, but this time Monster will die. And Marie Cartier is over the body of Georges. No, he's my brother, she says, although she's wearing just a regular sweater in the woods in this issue. Do you guys have thoughts on Herb Trimpe's pencils? I'm a big fan, but he draws a weird, dumb, big-toothed Hulk, but I really love his pencils. I think they're very dynamic.
I grew up with Herb Trimpe's pencils. I mean, so many of the books of my childhood were drawn by Herb Trimpe. So I have just incredible affection for his style. I mean, it doesn't hold up particularly well and, you know, by modern standards. And very soon, you'd have like Dave Cockrum and George Perez and John Byrne and Frank Miller coming in and really sort of showing him what's what. But I love it. And I also love the sort of almost Kirby-esque approach. I would say he's an acquired taste.
The sound effects by Artie Simek, who of course, classic Marvel, are huge and really diverse and odd throughout this book. That's one thing I'll say right away. We get a lot of really smart lettering. This book isn't as word dense as a lot of the books in this era were. We get a lot of sassy narration like we do in the 70s, but it's not as bad. I'll give just a couple examples. On page one, we see the Hulk landing in Appalachia, jumping, several miles like he does, and then just landing wherever he lands. And he's landing on a fence. And this first page cracks me up. This is the only one I'll do full dialogue on. We get, Appalachia was a nice place to visit, but he wouldn't want to live there. Or so thought the Hulk, in words pretty much to that effect, which helps to explain perhaps why the green-skinned Goliath is coming to a far from graceful landing at this very moment in the hills of upstate New York. So Hulker's here, but where is here? And then there's a guy in the corner. Oh my brand new fence. Heck, did you see what that gorilla just did to my fence? My brand new Naughty Pine $658.27 fence. Sure did, Jasper. Leastways, I think I did. This is such a great opening. The horses go bolting and the farmer just throws his hat on the ground. That sinks it. You've ruined my fence. Run off my horses. Just what do you intend to do now, gorilla? And Hulk's initially like, dude, I'm sorry. Actually, what am I thinking? I'm not sorry. I can beat you to death. And like stomps on the guy's hat and then just jumps away. What are your thoughts on the introductory scene? I always love Hulk's bumbling like into civilians. It makes me smile.
I appreciate Len's equal opportunity view of rednecks. Like everyone talks at Hick, no matter where you're from. I appreciate that. As someone who's actually from Appalachia, I'm glad they write us all ignorant and not just me.
But I grew up in the Ozarks, which is just a bunch of hillbillies, and I own it there too. I get it.
Yeah, well, they're all like hearing the way these guys talk, and I understand, like, I know that stereotypes can be a very effective use of, like, it's like a shorthand for a character. This guy's a farmer, and suddenly he starts talking like, gosh, my corns is hurting, it must be a gun of rain or whatever.
Like, I suppose I could have read his dialogue as like very Shakespearean, but it just seemed appropriate.
Yeah. you did right. Whenever I go back and read these old books, there's so much narration that gives it that kind of like pulpy feel that you just kind of expect from a book of this time,
There must be 1,000 speeches in comic book history of the Hulk ranting about how humans will just not leave him alone. He's hopping miles and miles away like a great green billiard ball as he's saying to himself, I just need a place to find peace. He lands with a thoom and knocks some trees over, and he's in the Canadian woods. And nearby, we have a government facility, which is technically, I think, the first appearance of Department H and the Weapon X project. They have recently had the Hulk on Canadian soil fighting the Flesh Eater, and they're like, oh man, we got to get rid of this guy. Somebody mobilize Weapon X, which is the technical first mention. Wolverine is called Weapon X before he's ever called Wolverine.
I love that. Well, first of all, this story takes place pre 9/11, and that's the only reason why the Hulk could jump, from Appalachia into Canada, without a passport or anything. It's funny, I kind of, this whole discussion is sort of premised for me on my assumption, which could be wrong, that Len probably did this book Marvel style, which meant that Herb was drawing off of a plot and then Len came in after the art was done and basically dialogued it and narrated it. I'm gonna guess that Len didn't have long-term plan in terms of who Wolverine was. Everything about Wolverine really kind of almost suggests a one-off. But the whole idea that there's a Department H and a Weapon X, and it's hard for me to kind of evaluate, like, oh, if I was reading this without knowing what Weapon X was or what Department H would become, I would probably just think, oh, he just, like, picked a noun and matched it to a letter. In hindsight, sounds really, really cool. Take nothing away from Lynn, who I actually think was a genius writer. You know, that I think that was an example of just getting very lucky.
So Hulk lands in the middle of the woods. The sun is setting, or at least the sky looks orange, and he's in the middle of a pack of ravenous wolves. I always hate when we see heroes beating up animals. It's one of my least favorite comic book things.
Yeah. Well, actually, there was something in the previous page I wanted to mention. I thought it was, it kind of caught my eye with the coloring and the art and all that. There is a Canadian officer with a weirdly tall, narrow head that talks in sort of a, almost like a British affectation, like calls him lieutenant and blah, blah, blah. I just kind of made me think again about the team's use of stereotype here. And it was made me think like Hulk has almost no forehead at all. Like his hair is like down to his eyes pretty much. And even the redneck is that way. He's got kind of a mop of hair that's just like very low to his eyes. And it just kind of made me think of the old term lowbrow, which was originally referred to cranial measurements. Basically a racist term.
Yeah.
I don't know. It kind of made me look at the rest of the book that way. Like the intelligent people have very tall foreheads, like tall, narrow heads. And
it's almost like there's more room for the brain in there.
Something. It's like a physical stereotype of which ones are the smart ones and which ones aren't. Anyway, that just kind of made me think of it. Like the smart ones in the book are in uniform with a very tall head. that accounts even for the stuff in Colonel Ross's office. Anyway, I thought it was weird. The guy straight up looks like Sinestro, kind of.
Kind of, yeah. Or the leader, right? Like
the leader is the one who's like the highest of brows and the smart.
Yeah, exactly, right.
So Philip, tell us about Hulk versus the Wolves.
This made me think of the Ang Lee film where it's Hulk against the
oh,
wolves.
Oh yeah. Oh, against the gamma dogs or something.
Gamma dogs.
With fucking Nick Nolte, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. The reason that movie was already kind of in my narrow head is Glenn Talbot is also in this book. Yeah. And he even says here, like, usually I like dogs, but I don't know. It's fine. It's just Hulk doing what Hulk does. And yeah, it is weird to see him like beating up on dogs, but they are swarming him. So I guess it's fine.
He like punches one in the face. He grabs one by the tail and tosses it. They all land in a ravine together. They like pack on top of him until he knocks them all off and sends them flying with a bwah whump. And he goes, go ahead, dogs, run from Hulk before Hulk smashes you all. And then we get this moment and the final dialogue box, the letters get really tiny here. And it makes me kind of sad. This is the pastiche for the Hulk, right? Hulk doesn't need nasty dogs to be Hulk's friend. Hulk doesn't need anyone. Hulk has Hulk to be Hulk's friends. Hulk always has Hulk. It is like very like those kids peeking out the window in the front of the Cat in the Hat book as it's raining outside, like, aw, you know. It's
right.
Poor Hulk, poor lonely Hulk. He punches and no one wants to be his friend.
I liked how they left the white space around the letters too. They made the lettering small, but they left the balloon as big as it should have been.
That struck me as a very modern choice.
Len Wein gives us a Hulk that has very big teeth, like a very large face, right? It's still 4 years before the Hulk series with Lou Ferrigno comes out, but this seems to almost be the inspiration for what that Hulk version looks like in the film. Like if you Google Lou Ferrigno as the Hulk, it seems to kind of almost have this artistic trend for a while. And
totally.
Her trippy's on the book for a little while.
The mop of hair and everything.
Yeah, yeah. Like the big green wig hair, you know. We jump to Hulk's supporting cast. It's not super relevant to the story in this book, but we see Thunderbolt Ross launching Project Green Skin, desperately trying to stay relevant. He's got a guy named that we talked about in the first Flesh Eater episode named Colonel Armbruster. Glenn Talbot's being a shit husband to Betty Banner and like screaming, and she's like, Glenn dear, it's okay, just calm down, I'm sorry daddy. Like there's a lot of that energy. We're just not going to spend a lot of time there. All of these characters become Hulks at some point, except for Armbruster. Like they're all some version of the Hulk at some point in their career. We jump back to Canada where Hulk is wandering through the Canadian wilderness. It's a small shot, but there's this gorgeous image that's almost covered by speech bubbles where it's like the clouds and the mountains in the distance as Hulk kind of has his Sound of Music moment, you know, the hills are alive. And then a voice in a pink bubble calls out to him, Hulk. Huh? Who is there? Who calls Hulk? And he turns around. Nobody's there. Funny. Hulk was sure somebody called. Must be bugs in Hulk's ear. And I read this Hulk as like that monster from the Looney Tunes cartoons that like gets.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, I will love him and squeeze him and hold him and his name will be George. Like that's how the
Hulk sounds. I was just thinking, I could listen to this forever. forever.
I do a lot of voices on my show.
It's great.
So
I love it. I love this
one anytime.
It's very good.
We get Hulk like really freaking out to these voices. He's not enjoying it. Hulk, come. No, leave Hulk alone. Stop talking. And Hulk said, come, Hulk, Hulk, come. And he's karate chopping trees. Where is she? Is she hiding under a rock, under behind tree? There's nobody there. She's drawing him in. There's a cave nearby. And inside, we see Marie Cartier and Georges Baptiste. Marie is wearing
a very cultural appropriation type of outfit.
It's kind of druidistic a little bit, but also very like First Nations in some ways. There's kind of a mix here.
Yeah, I think that's also very kind. I mean, I'm pretty sure that Herb didn't have First Nations in mind. It's more like, you know, again, just blatant cultural appropriation by way of what he thinks Native North Americans look like.
This gives me, again, strong Philip Kennedy Johnson vibes. We have a woman trying to save her, like, the soul of her brother from a monster that he's trapped in. And her idea is she's like somehow learned a bunch of magic. She like went off and got some training or like, I don't know, drank a potion somewhere, like studied with Baron Mordo. We don't know exactly how she learned this stuff, but she's got like some potions and horny hat, like a red hood and a fur collar. And she's very determined to save the soul of her brother. And her plan is to lure Hulk in, put him to sleep with a sleeping spell or potion, and then lure the flesh eater in and transfer the mind of the two creatures into the other. So her brother will get the Hulk's form, which I guess is more humane than the flesh eater's form, but I'm not sure Paul would be thrilled about this option, but that's her plan. It's very like Dr. Frankenstein. We're going to swap the minds of the monsters once the lightning strikes kind of energy.
I don't know, man. this is not my favorite Lynn story either, ever. Yeah, I think she probably could have chosen an easier patsy if she was going to do this. When she first started doing it, I don't know, I couldn't help but think of other ways it might have gone. It would have been easier for her if she'd picked some rando. When he's hearing the voice, she's calling him by name. She has been luring him there like this whole time.
Yeah, she's using Hulk, not Bruce, but she's definitely luring the monster in.
Yeah, it was such a weird choice. I don't know.
Despite the cultural appropriation, I love the way Herb Trimpe draws faces. This close-up of Marie, like with the horns, as she's talking about her determination to lure in the beast. And Georges is saying, like, you can't do this. It's inhumane. You can't do this. And she's using the guilt thing, right? Remember, Georges, Paul was studying to be a doctor, a healer of men when he went hunting with you and Henri Clouzot. If it wasn't for you, he would never have been caught in that cave, never have done what awesome. He did. You owe it to him to help me, Georges. You owe it to him. We learn next issue, he's in love with Marie. That's why he's here. He's trying to get her to turn back, but it's too late because she's already got the stone tables. They look like little cots in a cave. There's like little burning braziers, and she's braziers meaning like pots, not like bras, but you know, maybe there's those in the corner too. We don't know.
And I think it's a pronoun. Is it braziers?
Brazers? I'm just going to go to like Bette Midler and Beaches, the over-the-shoulder boulder holder. We're going to let it be there. You know, Georges is asking the question, what right have you to condemn another to the horrible fate your brother now endures? What right have you to condemn a man to hell? But she's been studying what she literally calls the dark arts, and she is ready and she is determined because Hulk is already on his way. When Hulk enters the cave, he initially is like, oh, you're the person responsible for the voices. And she's luring him in. Hulk always gets distracted by either children, puppies, or like pretty women. He's like, oh, maybe I should be your friend. You will be Hulk's friend, right? And especially if it's a blonde white woman, right? Like he's automatically lured in. There's a weakness for him here. He's like, you're almost familiar to me. And she's like, yes, Hulk, we need your help. She like made him a plate of cookies and a pot.
Yeah, she's like, this is here. Drink this. And Hulk's not a very street smart type of monster. He's like, yeah, that's fine. Strange woman, strange cave. Why not?
She says, are you enjoying your dinner, Hulk? Food is good, animal girl. Thank you. And almost my favorite panel here is Georges is in the corner with his full hand on his face. You can't do this, Marie. The poor brute is so simple. Yeah, so gullible.
This is so embarrassing.
I'm with him, actually. It is a little embarrassing.
And here's some nice broth to wash your cookies down. But Hulk is suddenly very sleepy and he just passes out. Because she has summoned the vapors of slumber, and now they have to lure the monster in. And we finally get the appearance of the flesh eater. But before that, Marie is kind of creepy casting spells, her graceful jaw firmly set. Marie Cartier then turns her attention away from her remorseful companion and back to the mystic potions she has tended so carefully these many days past. Then, in a tongue far older than the towering maple trees that abound nearby, she softly begins to chant, a sing-song supplication that is carried up out of the earthen hovel upon pungent swirling mists to spread like a rampant breeze throughout the verdant forest, where something finally hears the chant and stirs. And there's a light from the moon. The captions call her a witch woman. The light wakes Hulk up, even though she's like pouring her Eye of Newt or whatever into her little spell. I really enjoy the narration here. I think Len Wein has a really lovely way of doing narration.
Some good SAT words. Application abound.
It's like, again, I'm not Len Wein. You're absolutely right. Absolutely a genius. The style back then, though, was like, are they, it's like they were trying to prove that they were real writers or something. Like they were trying to write in the style of the novelizations of the time. Just real, you know, that's just the style, right? Just
very as a guy who does like deep cultural comic book analysis on a regular basis, there's like a very heavy prose narration in the early 70s that Claremont is very involved in as well, right? Oh. This is our early.
Oh my God, yeah. I've gone back to read like old Kirby stuff a lot recently. Damn, dude, it's a slog sometimes. Like it's just so different than what we're used to now.
We get Georges' final attempt to appeal to Marie. Is there no way to dissuade you from this mad scheme, Marie? Think, girl. Would your brother want to regain his humanity at the cost of another soul? Will Paul be able to live with your sins on his conscience? And she says, those are questions I cannot answer, Georges. Why don't you ask them of Paul instead? Oh, my Lord. And he turns around and the flesh eater is in the doorway. Philip, how does this monster hold up to some of Marvel's modern monsters? Is this a character that you find fascinating and frightening?
Right here, he just looks like a white version of Hulk, kind of. But I love the idea. I love that they took this legend and made a legit thing of it. And that there's an actual like reason for it. It's not like, I know the other thing you're talking about too, the missing link. And there's so many monsters out there that are just a big muscular guy. That's just like somewhere between 8 and 10 feet tall. And they have to find some half-baked reason for it. The stuff that's going on right now in the Vegas arc, there's the arc that's going on now in shelves called City of Idols. I originally pitched that, but they were, hopefully I'm not going to get in trouble here for talking inside baseball. But
Saladin Ahmed is using the Flesh Eater in the new Wolverine volume that's coming out.
Yeah, right. I was not able to use him for that reason. So I made up a new creature, kind of like instead we introduced the Cult of Lycana, which is like the first skinwalker, like the saint of skinwalkers, basically. Just invented all this new lore around it that's not unlike the monster that we see here.
You create the creepiest monsters. I love your book. It's very Beowulf. I really love reading your book stuff. It's just delightful.
I appreciate that. I think this creature is awesome. I think it's a great foil. Honestly, it's a great foil for Hulk as well as Wolverine. I love seeing him in both books.
It always weirds me out when artists, and this seems to happen almost in every issue of the Hulk somewhere, where his head gets just proportionately smaller to the size of his shoulders and body.
So make a big guy, right?
Hulk turns around and he's awake, and Marie's plans would have gone according to plan had the Hulk not woken up from the spell. But when he sees the Flesh Eater in the doorway of the cave, he is very upset and immediately leaps into action. She tries to stop him. No, Hulk, listen, wait, listen to me. The Flesh Eater's your friend. He isn't here to hurt anyone. He's only... But the Hulk slams himself into the monster. There's a giant kwoom. The cave wall is collapsing. And then we get our one kind of full page shot of the Flesh Eater punching Hulk right in the face. And it's very 60s Batman, right? Blam! Like we get the wah, wah, wah sound effects here as the sound effects get really crazy. The narrator lets us know that this might be the battle of the century with a side note that says Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali eat your hearts out. It's just stupid.
It's such a Stan Lee type of editorial comment, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
While Hulk yells that he is the strongest one there is, he picks up a, quote, baggage car-sized boulder and throws it at the Flesh Eater with a scream. The mini Gibraltar merely crumbles against the Flesh Eater's ivory pelt. Then Hulk drop kicks him in the gut and the creature just starts screaming his own name. He grabs a tree with a scrump. Hulk rips the whole ground up with a cragged. And then they headbutt into each other with a boom. That shot of the two of them like smashing their heads together. Like a pair of enraged rhinos, the two Goliaths thunder across the clearing to collide head on. And we do mean head on.
Oh my God.
Some of the prose is really ridiculous.
I love a good dad joke.
And Mark, tell us what happens on the last page.
They hear a voice that, you know, which I assume was a very heavy Canadian accent, saying that if you guys want to tussle with someone, I forget what word Lynn used.
If you really want to tangle with someone, why not try to look against the Wolverine?
There's nothing better for an introduction of a character than for them to refer themselves in the third person.
There's a fist fight between the two monsters, and this guy jumps out, and the caption, and this is where the book closes. Well, now you know what, or who, Weapon X is, faithful one. He's a living, raging powerhouse who's bound around and knock you back on your emerald posterior. Be here next time, Arbalite, since the Wolverine strikes but once. But in his case, once is plenty. And Wolverine's classic costume here. It's the first version of here. I have Ali Garza drawing a print of this costume for my wall, which I'm really excited about. What is distinguishable about this costume as opposed to Wolverine's classic costume? There's a couple distinguishing features here.
The face is, you know, the helmet or the face mask, whatever you want to call it, is completely different. The ears are much smaller and I would argue less successful than...
Also whiskers on this mask, which is crazy. Yes. You get the
whiskers
idea
that the gloves... Cute little button nose.
You get the idea that his claws or his gloves have claws on them. Now stay tuned for next episode. We're going to talk about why the introduction of Wolverine is so huge and why he kind of revolutionized the industry and caught on so well. So stay tuned for my conversation with Erica and Paul next episode for that. What are your thoughts as we kind of conclude our review of Incredible Hulk number 180?
See, there were just all these things that stick out. Like anytime I go back and read an old comic, including ones I loved back in the day, I'm just struck by, as someone who's like just cranking these out all the time now, I'm struck by all these differences and how much the medium has changed. Everything from like layouts, like panel layouts to, I mean, language first and foremost, that's my business. But also, I don't know, I still feel so ignorant compared to many of the people that I work with, to include people like Mark and you, honestly. Like I learned to love comics from so few books and completely left comics utterly for a long, like when I was in college, I didn't read for fun at all for, you know, I was studying music. And so I just sold my soul to the practice room and didn't read a comic for years. And I feel like I've been playing catch up even now that I'm doing it. I'm just like constantly trying to read old stuff and catch up and learn, you know, stuff that I've missed or just kind of catch up, not just with the state of the art right now, but you know, how we got here. And reading these books is very eye opening for me. And I do wonder about behind the scenes stuff too. Like again, forgive my ignorance if you guys know about this, but you were talking about Flesh Eater's head size. Some of these faces look redrawn to me. I don't know if maybe there was I don't know if it was a size thing or if the editor in chief at the time didn't like the design of the face or something, but these look edited. These look like they've been like literally pasted on. Do you guys think that?
Yeah. And that was very common at the time. There was John Romita Sr. had a group of artists called Romita's Raiders who would routinely go and redraw faces and figures and always in response to some sort of editorial, you know, note. It's so incredibly common, like at this, especially in this moment in comics. DC was doing it also, you know, very famously. They would have Kurt Swan redraw Superman's face and Neil Adams, you know. Chad, you were asking like, what's my takeaway from the book? It's like, to me, it's such a, you know, just such a quintessential example of Marvel in the 70s. It's a very, from the sound effects to the purple prose narration to, you know, Herb, you know, sort of trying to adhere as much as he can to that Jack Kirby-esque house style from the 60s. It's basically like a quintessential Marvel book from the 70s. You know,
One piece of insider baseball that I do know, this final page that has Wolverine drawn on it for the very first time burned up in a house fire several years ago.
Oh my God, really?
Would probably be worth bajillions of dollars.
Oh my God.
Lost in a fire. What a joy to have you both on the show. My show has been focused so much on the original X-Men and their early continuity. It's such a joy to be in this era where the tones are starting to shift and we get new characters to talk about, although I've had a great time going back to the wonky, crazy Silver Age stuff. It's lovely to have you both on. I would love to have you both back this time.
Thanks, man.
As we are wrapping up, let me hear any final thoughts you have. Where can people find you both online? And we're going to put this out at the end of October. Is there anything you would like to plug? Let's go, Mark, and then Philip.
At Comic-Con, we have announced my next book for Marvel, which is going to be a ongoing Star Wars Jedi Knights series focused on the Jedi Knights prior to Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
I'm having a blast with it. Self-contained, and it's kind of like a Marvel 2-in-1 / Brave and the Bold approach where, Philip, it's very, very comics of your childhood because they're all done in ones with just different combinations of Jedi, and I'm having too much fun with that book. In terms of where you can find me, the best place is I do a mostly weekly, usually every other week, newsletter on Substack called Legal Dispatch. If you go to substack.markguggenheim.com, you'll be able to find it.
And I'm so sorry I pronounced it Guggenheim at the start of the episode.
Oh, that's okay. I, by the I didn't even know.
And Philip.
Find me. I have a website, philipkennedyjohnson.com. I try to be up to date on there with what books are coming out. I am on most places at either my full name or at Philip K. Johnson. The books I have coming out right now are Batman and Robin, an unannounced thing that I'm really excited about, but I digress. We'll talk about that another time. Hopefully you want to come back on here.
Please.
A new book, and I'm doing it at to speak of political things. So I am still active duty military right now, so I'm forbidden from like talking openly politics, but I can write fictional comic books, which is why we're doing Hell Hunters, which is my Nazi killing fantasy. It takes place in World War II. It's like Marvel. It's Marvel's Inglorious Bastards, straight up.
Love
with
it.
all of Marvel's like most badass World War II characters. So it's got like, it's the origin actually of Ghost Rider 44 that appeared in my Hulk Hulk book, but it's also with like Logan, Nick Fury, Peggy Carter, Teenage Bucky, the Soldier Spring. It's gonna be so fun.
Mark's soon. Wife helped write the Peggy Carter series, as I recall. Yeah, this is
oh my god, seriously, I love that show.
Thank you. Yeah, she loved
working on it. Please give her my deepest compliments on that show. I loved it.
Thank you.
My creator-owned Crocodile Black just wrapped up, and I'm forgetting something, and somebody's gonna be mad at me.
I mean, Incredible Hulk.
Well, Incredible Hulk ongoing. So I guess maybe that's everything. Before we go though, I want to give you guys your props. Like Chad, you've been doing this a long time, and you're so consistent, so professional about this, and I'm always hard to get a hold of, and I really appreciate you. It's always love seeing this show up. And Mark, when that, forgive the ball washing here, but when that guy came after you on Twitter, I got legit pissed because I'm so impressed with the fact that you're just like this guy who just decided that there needs to be this superhero universe on TV and just made it. I can't believe what you did, man. Like, it was just such a Herculean task. Making a comic book is hard. And there are so many moving parts to what you've done. I can't even fathom what it must have taken. So I just am so impressed with what you've done, of the thing that exists purely because of what you've done. So thanks, the man. Biggest props to you for your work.
Thank you. Well, I work with a lot of super talented people, and it was a monumentally huge team effort.
I'm sure that's true, but anyway, I think your work's great.
Gray Malkin Lane, you can follow Gray Malkin _Lane on Instagram. Please watch for Incredible Hulk number 181 in our very next episode featuring Erica Schultz and Paul Jenkins. Thank you everybody for listening. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Philip. We will see you all back here next time on Gray Malkin Lane. Thank you for listening to Gray Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Gray Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Gray Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Gray Malkin Lane.